In the Jamaicans, you have a people who are constitutionally disorderly. It's simply in their makeup. They're constitutionally disposed to be anti-authority. Kenneth Newman, Commissioner of the London Metropolitan Police, 1982. The former commissioner's quote opened the 2021 exhibition War in a Babylon, curated by Kamara Scott, Rihanna Jade Parker and Stafford Scott. The bold white writing sat atop a stark black background at the Institute of Contemporary Arts. I think about that exhibition a lot. I think about the comments of Kenneth Newman and the fact that he was commissioner of the Met Police. And I think about the way policing, the reporting of policing, and the media more widely are still one of the most racist institutions in Britain. Still. Welcome to the History Hotline, a direct line to a better understanding of all things Black history and beyond. Everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lynn Cook, and as always, I will be your host today. Thank you so much for your patience as I had a little summer holiday break. I am back now for the foreseeable, and on today's episode, we'll be thinking about policing and just how little it has changed since my grandparents came here in the 1950s and 60s. I'll be thinking about this idea of little changing historically. I think over the next two or three episodes, we'll focus on policing, and then I think we'll go into politics and media and the far right. But also, you know, as always, if you have any recommendations, please do let me know what you want to hear on this podcast, and I'll see what I can do. That includes topics, events, individuals, and also guests you'd like to feature. I do like opening up this space for guests to come and talk about the things that they're researching and the historical work that they're doing. So please, if you have any recommendations, do let me know. And before we get into the episode, I have a little bit of housekeeping. So something I've been pondering for a while now, I can't remember when I switched to doing fortnightly episodes. I think it might have been either the new year or actually last year this time. I really can't remember, but I've really missed doing weekly episodes. I've missed having the space to kind of think over things on a weekly basis, let my ideas marinate from week to week, as opposed to kind of holding them all in and then like giving a really somewhat, in my mind, sometimes disjointed episode where there's a lot to talk about and the topics don't really seamlessly go into each other. And I think whilst that works, you know, for those of you that listen week by week and are really keeping up with the kind of contemporary trend and then the episode that might link to that, I think listening back over a long span of time, and, you know, there are episodes that live longer because they are a historical narrative, not so much centered on a contemporary moment that can't be understood and can't be thought through outside of that contemporary moment. And I feel like some of the earlier episodes I used to do can just be taken and listened to at any point, whereas some of the kind of more reactionary episodes really only make sense within the context of them being posted. So of course there'll still be those contemporary reactionary episodes, but I do want to make room for more kind of historically focused episodes, more interviews with people that are doing historical work so they can also share the stories and the histories that they know and they love. And so I am going to be bringing back weekly episodes. Hooray! You should all be cheering. If you're not cheering, then you're in the wrong place. This will be on a, let's say, a somewhat trial basis till December, because weekly episodes are a massive commitment, and we will see how it goes. But I really do hope you enjoy the next kind of wave of episodes. I have some amazing guests coming on, some really cool topics planned, and some really kind of well-curated episodes, which is what I want to get back into. And you know, I'm sure the world is going to provide me with some inspiration, because the news cycles these days are actually crazy, and potentially could be getting crazier as we hear more about the former government's mess that they left, and also the current government's plans to kind of fix things or attempt to fix things. Not sure who exactly they're fixing things for. It doesn't seem like for the average person, but I will hold thoughts on that as it is very early days. So as we get into this kind of new phase of podcasting, it's the fourth year technically. As we get into this phase, I am hoping to do more kind of in-person things. As those of you will know, we had the Black British History quiz a few weeks ago. Thank you all so much for coming to that. It was an amazing experience. It was so cool to meet some of you there, and also just open up the podcast to people that, you know, didn't know about it, found out through social media, you know, the platform the tickets were sold on, or from other places. So thank you all for coming. Whether there'll be another quiz anytime soon, that is a question for somebody else. We shall see. But for now, I do have two live show events coming up. The first one is the first live show that I will ever do, and I'm very excited for it. It's going to be on the 15th of September, so less than 2 weeks away. At 2 p.m. at King's Place, which is in King's Cross in London. And I will be joined by the incredible Dr. Jade Bentall, who will be talking about, well, a lot of things, actually. Primarily our work conducting research for Jade on Black women and for myself on Black children in a historical context. Doing that work using oral histories, I'm going to talk about, you know, that as a methodology and how that can be used to forward the aims of Black British history, especially at a time where there seems to be so many pushbacks. And we'll be talking about the field of Black British history and how we see it moving forwards, as well as kind of honouring where it is right now and thinking through and reflecting on that. So I'm very, very excited. I hope you can all be there. Tickets are available. Links will be in the show notes, of course. And the second live show that we have is going to be on the 19th of October. That's a Saturday, and it's going to be at the Imperial War Museum. And I will be interviewing Colin Douglas, who published The Caribbean and the Second World War. And we will be talking about just that, his book, and also more broadly, the Caribbean and the Second World War. And just thinking through the kind of exclusion of Caribbean people from that narrative, and what Colin has done in this text and also previous texts that I've personally relied on so heavily, conducting my own research, doing my master's, writing about Caribbean women during World War II. His work has been something that I've always looked up to in an academic setting, and just, you know, what it can do for also public history narratives. So I'm super excited to sit and chat with him. It's part of the Imperial War Museum's kind of live podcasting day, and they have a variety of podcasts on the day that will be presenting live with a variety of guests on a variety of topics relating to war histories and military histories. Not something that I'm necessarily associated with, so I'm quite excited to be in this space thinking about war. I really do kind of geek out on World War II, only because I think the potential for social change that we saw following it was actually really important, really interesting, and also just the kind of way that ordinary people are associated with war, how they understand war in the kind of the during it and also in the aftermath and kind of legacies of war. Found it really interesting during the COVID time where people were speaking of what we were going through in lockdowns and things like that, kind of like this war spirit and us having to pull together as a country to make it through. Very interesting to me. So I will be there popping in and out of some of the other podcast shows, as well as, of course, doing mine. I think mine is at 4 p.m. It's a 45 minute podcast, so you won't have to be sitting there for your whole Saturday. And there also will be a podcasting panel at the end of the day where myself and other hosts will be speaking through, you know, doing podcasts, doing history podcasts, what it's like. So if you want any more information about things like that, again, links are in the show notes. And I think that's everything. And now I'm going to take you through a quiz, because I feel like I've been talking for a really long time. And this quiz is all about policing, and it's going to be a nice little introduction into today's episode. I'm going to read five statements to you, and you have to tell me if they were written in the 1960s or the 2020s based solely on their content. Now, you're not actually going to tell me. You can shout it out. If you're listening to this, I don't know, in the car with other people, then you can do the quiz between yourselves. But if you are listening to this on your own, maybe you're at the gym, going for a run, doing your cleaning, then remember the answers. There's only five statements. Five statements, and you have to tell me if they were written in the 1960s or 2020s. I've taken out all the time-specific language, terms like West Indian, date references, things like that. So you're only judging it based on the context, not trying to pick up language clues, because that's not what this activity is about. So our first statement. I don't really know why I just said I've been talking for ages when this is literally a podcast of me talking for ages and has been for the past 4 years. But anyway, the first statement, and I quote, "One officer could be seen kicking and stomping on the head of a man in prone position. These are the latest to spark a public and political argument in Britain over police violence." End quote. That was statement number one. Statement number two. "The ugly truth is that the organisation is riddled with racism." End quote. And the organisation being the London Metropolitan Police. And if you listen closely, you'll even hear them at the end of that quote. Wow, look at that. If you say their name loud enough, they will appear. Anyway, the third statement, and you remember off trying to figure out if they were written in the 1960s or 2020s. Here we go. "The members of the party were humiliated, threatened, assaulted, and otherwise manhandled. The writer was a witness to this episode and was surprised to find that policemen could be so inhuman and behave in such an indignified manner to decent families." End quote. The fourth statement. "Eyewitnesses to an incident last year revealed when a man sought assistance from police after his car was involved in an accident. One of them asked, 'What do you black bastard want?' This brought about an exchange of words as to the abruptness of the officers. The result of this was that the officers took the man to the police station by dragging him along the road, beat him up at the station, and charged him for assault." End quote. And the final statement reads, quote, "I can't in good faith recommend this job to my own community. If someone from my community wants to join, I'll support them. But I can't say this is the best job in the world for you." And that's from a Met police officer. So you had five statements there and you were to guess whether they were from the 1960s or the 2020s. Now, I will say two of those quotes were from the 1960s, if that helps at all. And they were from a text written by Joseph Hunt called Nigger Hunting. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. The other three were from the 2020s. And two of them were actually from the Casey report, Baroness Casey's report in 2023. And another one was from a news article written in 2024, only a few months ago. So, the point of that exercise, don't worry, I will tell you the answer shortly, was to kind of ask the question, essentially, has anything changed from this report of sorts that's written in 1966, I think published in 67, of Joseph Hunt, where he's asking this question, well, why is there such a kind of disconnect between black people and policing? Why is there such tension there? Why do black people feel like they're being overpoliced, underprotected? Why do the police, seem so heavy-handed when it comes to policing black people? And these questions are being asked, and they're similar questions that are still being asked today. And, you know, the Casey report seemingly having some of those answers that being published in 2023. So the first quote was taken from the news report of this year, and it was in reference to the man that was seemingly in the clip that went over viral on social media, was being attacked by the Greater Manchester Police at Manchester Airport. The second quote about the ugly truth is that the organisation is riddled with racism. That was from a Met police officer in the Casey report in 2023. So two contemporary examples. The next two, which you might have been able to tell, just for the way maybe even the writing was so violent in a sense, were from the 60s. one of them speaking about the party. It was a wedding party where people were humiliated, threatened, assaulted and manhandled. And then the next one was about the man who sought assistance from the police when he'd been in a car accident and was met with racist abuse. They were from 1964 and 1965. And then the last one, the officer saying, "I can't in good faith recommend this job to my own community," was also from the Casey report in 2023. And they speak to some of the issues with A, how the police are tackling crime, B, how police officers that are coming from different backgrounds, non-white backgrounds, feel about recommending policing to their communities, talking about the organisation as a whole, so as an institution, and then the ways in which police, you know, as people that are supposed to be within society to protect people, are just simply not doing that and not assisting them, and instead using their own racial prejudice to react and to respond to the needs of the people. Now, there have been two official independent inquiries that have labelled the Metropolitan Police as institutionally racist. This feels like old times again, where I used to talk about the Metropolitan Police like nearly every episode. Well, we're back. We're back to talking about them once again. The first time the Met was labelled as institutionally racist was during the McPherson Report of 1999. The term was first formally applied to the force, which was investigating the police handling of the murder of Stephen Lawrence in 1993. The report concluded that the Met was institutionally racist due to its failure to adequately investigate the crime due to the victim's race. And then again, in the Casey Review, Baroness Casey's report, Louise Casey, her full name, Baroness Louise Casey, and that report was published in 2023, which followed the investigation into the murder of Sarah Everard by a serving Metropolitan Police officer. The Casey Review not only criticised the Met for being institutionally racist, but also described it as institutionally misogynistic and homophobic. So in some ways, potentially getting worse in its actual labelling anyway. I'm sure there might have been instances of misogyny and homophobia in the Met Police in 1999, when the McPherson report came out, but that was obviously not what Sir McPherson was looking for or writing about. But interesting that the Casey Review is able to bring that out, especially in the context of Sarah Everard's murder. Now, this is not to say that pre-1999 it wasn't believed that the Met had problems with racism. As you know from reports where the quotes came from, like Joseph Hunt's Nigger Hunting, which came out in 1966, you know, you heard extracts from that where the Met are clearly showing proof of being racist, having racial prejudice, and acting on it. In official reporting, the label of racist comes up in the Scarman Report in 1981, where the term institutional racism is not explicitly used, but the Scarman Report, which follows the Brixton riots and other uprisings that are happening in major cities and in areas, smaller areas within major cities in 1981, criticised the Met Police for racial prejudice and poor community relations. This report highlighted systemic issues that many people would argue laid the groundwork for the use of the term institutional racism in 1999. Another time that, you know, questions of race in policing come up are following the 2020 Black Lives Matter protests. Various activists and commentators and, you know, people that had faced police brutality and were obviously thinking about that in the context of George Floyd's murder, called out the Met again for institutional racism. Though, you know, in those instances, that wasn't necessarily an official report. It was public discourse, and it was, as much as it might have been factual, it was an opinion, and not so much a formal declaration like we see in the Casey Review and the McPherson Report. However, these are all instances, whether, you know, coming from organisations, individuals, or from independent inquiries, of police being labelled as having some kind of racist agenda, or a racist issue or racial prejudice, whether it's at officer level or the institution as a whole. The term institutional racism was actually first coined in 1967 by Kwame Ture, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, and Charles V. Hamilton in their text, Black Power, The Politics of Liberation. And this is obviously in a US context, but a lot of the terminology when we think about race, even in Britain, does come from a US context, and I don't think we should ever shy away from that. However, when it came to policing, this term was actually not used in Britain until 1999. I'm sure those who were well-read and understood things that were happening in America that were following Black Power movements in the US and were inspired by it could definitely call it out in Britain too. But as an official statement, that only comes in 1999. In Britain, there have been countless studies from criminologists, sociologists, historians and the like on policing of Black people in Britain, most notably in the 1960s and 70s when things were really dire, I think. Probably, arguably, potentially at their worst, the use of force by officers as well as the sheer will to just, as kind of Joseph Hunt's work describes, just brutalise Black people for no real reason, I think speaks to one of the three issues often cited in scholarship on policing. Now, the first issue is racial stereotyping of Black people. And now in 1982, sociology lecturer John Fernandez released essays that were written by police cadets. I believe they were leaked, actually, at the Metropolitan Police Training School in Hendon, which is in London. The police cadets were asked to write an essay on the topic Blacks in Britain in order for John Fernandez, who was a lecturer and was training officers, to understand the kind of current understanding that the cadets had on Black people, kind of where they were, just to kind of measure and understand where they were so that he could set his curricula in an appropriate way. And the following quotes are exact quotes, I will say, taken from these cadets' essays. There were like so many quotes to potentially select, but I will share these. These are kind of often cited when this exercise is mentioned in articles or in writing. And I think they really do very cleverly highlight an important point about policing. And I quote, from cadet number one, "It makes me cringe when I see a Black bloke going out with a white woman. England is a traditionally white country, and that is how it should stay. The Blacks must accept that if they are to live in this country, they must fall in line under white British dictators and not try and run the country themselves from the Black..." Sorry. "From the back street slums," our second cadet says. And I quote, nice and short and sweet, "I think all Blacks are pains and should be expelled from our society." Number three, "Blacks in Britain are a pest. Quite frankly, I don't have any liking whatsoever for..." And he uses three racist terms that I'm not going to repeat on this podcast. "They are by nature unintelligent and can't at all be educated sufficiently to live in a civilized society of the Western world." Now, these are all coming from police cadets. And whilst we're talking about this first issue of racist stereotyping, the second issue that scholarship often cites is police culture, which we don't actually have to go much further to understand. In response to that last quote that I used, the response from a senior member of that college, someone in a senior position, I'm assuming some kind of officer role, they responded to this idea that, quote unquote, "Blacks in Britain are a pest. Quite frankly, I don't have any liking whatsoever for," insert racial slurs, "they are by nature unintelligent and can't at all be educated sufficiently to live in a civilized society of the Western world. Their response was, "If I had the slightest suspicion that one of the young cadets had serious deep prejudices, rather than shallowly expressed prejudices like that, then I would not recommend him to be a constable." So he's essentially saying in response to that quote, which I'm not saying the racial slurs because I just don't feel like it's appropriate for me to say them. You know, they've used racial slurs, and this officer, this senior person, is saying that they that's actually just a shallow prejudice, a shallowly expressed prejudice, and they actually don't have a serious deep prejudice. If they did, they wouldn't recommend them to be a constable, but because they don't, it's fine. This idea that, yeah, they wouldn't recommend them to be a constable, great, but they would still recommend them to be, what, an officer, which actually is probably worse because they'll be having regular interactions with a growing population of Black people in the public that they're probably going to end up serving. But, you know, it speaks to police culture, I think, in quite a mild sense at the time. But it gives a good example of that, I think. We could take more extreme examples of police culture and policing culture. The way Stephen Lawrence's murder was handled being the most obvious. The group chat comments made by officers who took pictures of the literal dead bodies of murdered sisters, Nicole Smallman and Bieber Henry. According to evidence produced for the trial, they would have actually had to enter the bush and like woodlands itself where the dead bodies lay, A, risking contamination of the crime scene to get their group chat pictures. They actually went on to edit the pictures. One of the officers actually edited, embossed his face into it in like a selfie style. The other sent them to inexperienced trainee officers he was supposed to be mentoring. One of the group chats that the image was posted in had 41 police officers in it. And I just wonder how long it took a single one of them to speak up and report it. I wonder how common things like that are in the force. I wonder how many other images of dead black women are on the phones of police officers, former police officers, and in their group chats, you know? That, to me, very clearly speaks to policing culture. It doesn't sound like a good kind of culture, work culture, societal culture, but they're the examples we're working with, right? The third issue is police personality, often cited in scholarship, which I find is something that's spoken a lot more about in the US when it comes to racism. People often talk about police in the US being uneducated sometimes and, you know, kind of it being a job that anybody can do. You don't need specific qualifications. You don't need any qualifications is the way it's portrayed. But I think when it comes to the context in Britain, I don't know if it's common knowledge of the qualifications you need to be a police officer or the personality, which is what the scholarship talks about, in which the majority of police officers have. Now, in Anita Colunter-Crumpton's article, which is called Policing Black People in Britain, great article, it's been argued that a police officer's personality tends to be morally and politically conservative in nature. And the police force often attracts those kinds of personalities. They write, and I quote, "In a study of police recruits by Coleman and Gorman in 1982, this analysis of police personality is made," and a quote from Coleman and Gorman. "It seems reasonable to conclude that the police force tends to attract to it people who are conservative and authoritarian than those of comparative socioeconomic status in other professions." Similarly, in Robert Rayner's The Politics of Police, which came out in the 90s, 1992, he states that the police force, and I quote, "has from the start been constructed as a hierarchical, tightly disciplined organisation. Thus, the police officer with a conservative outlook is more likely to fit in. Processes of selection and self-selection lead police officers to be conservative." And this is supported by criminologists like Simon Holdaway's observations about police personalities, and also can be supported by the quotes we had from John Fernandez's leaked police cadets and the responses. I'm sure, you know, the fact that these police cadets are cadets, they're cadets only, they aren't actually officers just yet. I'm sure they carried their prejudice to the roles as officers if that's what they went on to do. But they are just cadets interested in policing and holding these views already without a single day on the job. It's not like, you know, they've had to police certain things, they've seen certain things. You know, these are members of society, young members of society, that have taken on these views and then decided that policing is for them. I don't think that they would have necessarily been in policing environments enough for the police force to give them those thoughts and feelings. I think that's something that's coming from society. Now, to take us back to the quote I started with from Commissioner of the Met Police, Kenneth Newman, who said, and I quote, "In the Jamaicans, you have a people who are constitutionally disorderly. It's simply in their makeup. They're constitutionally disposed to be anti-authority." Now, whilst there might be Jamaican people that feel in opposition to authority, they might be anti-authority, you can't really generalise a whole race of people. Of course you can't. Kenny did, but you really shouldn't. Especially when you're actually dealing with, and you know, the Jamaicans that Commissioner Kenny would have been dealing with actually were the generation of Windrush generation, post-war Caribbean immigrant generation that arrived to Britain from Jamaica. You know, in their Sunday best, suited and booted. didn't really ever see them outside of their Sunday best. I don't think I've seen a Caribbean person, an elder especially, and by elder I literally just mean anyone over 40 in this context, outside of a suit or a really formal. And don't get me wrong, obviously I know that people dress differently then, and the standard of dress was a lot more formal, but they were really dressed to the nines, you know. They put on their good English clothes to come over to this country. They were sent things from England. Marks and Spencer shirts and shoes shined to get over here, to put their best foot, shined foot forwards. And were very proud of the way that they carried themselves. They were very authority, I would say, for the most part, to generalise. They did their best to accept the situation in Britain, despite all its horrors, the racism in housing, in healthcare and policing and jobs and everything, schools, you know. Now, I'm not obviously saying that all post-war migrants were Jamaican. Absolutely not. We know this. However, I will say that most black people that came from the Caribbean at that time were assumed to be Jamaican because of the native English people's ignorance. So actually, for the most part, maybe they were all, or most of them were believed to be Jamaican. And this is where this is coming from, this generalization. I think actually an interesting point now I'm here, that the way that non-Caribbean people think about the Caribbean is very Jamaica-centric. And of course, Jamaicans migrated here in vast numbers and have a very global culture. Which I often think is good, but sometimes I think is really bad because it's been super commercialized and is losing a lot of authenticity, and probably should be gatekept a little bit more. But here we are, we're here now. And it probably speaks to the fact of why I saw so many Jamaican flags at carnival being worn by people that were clearly not Jamaican. And maybe it's because they deeply resonate with the culture, or... which seems more likely, the fact that they actually don't know anything about any other Caribbean nation, which is quite a shame because the Caribbean islands and nations are really cool in their own way, outside of their proximity to Jamaicanness or, you know, being tropical islands and holiday getaways. They all have unique cultures whilst having the similarities and shared histories with others in the region. There's just so much to be said about their food culture, their music, everything, you know. So, yeah, I kind of wanted to just get that tangent off. But take us back to Kenneth Newman's comments about this constitutional disposition to be anti-authority towards a generation that probably, for the most part, and especially initially, really did try and fall in line when they came to Britain. You know, when things got dire, they stepped up, of course, and I'm not ever going to try and take away the narratives of resistance that generation went through. But I also find it quite interesting that that's the way he's described people, Jamaican people, black immigrants, potentially. But I think it's probably also, you know, coming from things that happened in the year preceding this 1982 statement. 1981 started with the New Cross fire, where 13 young black children, a 14th, would die later on, but died, and you know, barely anyone said anything. That led to the People's Day of Action, which was peaceful as a protest, but, you know, how the police perceive a small group of black people, let alone a large group of 20,000. It also saw racial uprisings later on in the year, in the summer, across major cities, which I've spoken a little bit about already, in 1981. And then, you know, when we're even going back a little bit further, 1976, 1977, the Notting Hill Carnival riots, the Carnival of 76 most notably saw an increase in overwhelming police presence, which caused high tensions, led to clashes with police and carnival goers as they tried to convict a pickpocketer, an alleged pickpocketer, or an alleged gang of pickpocketers. I'm using terms and language that the papers have reported are not the terms that I would necessarily believe, especially thinking about the way that the media have portrayed Notting Hill Carnival this year, and the things that have been written about it and the way it's been, spoken about, shall we say, or reported on. Next week's episode will be all about policing carnival, which is why I'm being deliberately vague and not actually saying what I want to say. especially now that I think the dust is settling from some of the terrible carnival hot takes and think pieces I've seen on social media following Notting Hill Carnival this year. I'm going to be putting together an episode on the riots of the late 1970s at Notting Hill Carnival. Also be breaking down the term riots, because I think considering the summer we've had, it will be an important thing to do. And also hopefully thinking about the ways that the media report on Notting Hill Carnival, not just in Britain, but globally. I was reading articles that were going out in, you know, today's context around the world about Notting Hill Carnival, and seeing the way it's portrayed on different news platforms in the US, in the Caribbean, and in West Africa as well. I don't know how I got there. But also actually the way that the 1976 and 77 carnival riots were portrayed in publications in the same places, the Caribbean and the US. I actually didn't see any about from West Africa, but it would be an interesting archival search. So yeah, this episode I hope brought together ideas about policing and sets quite a nice context for us to then understand the riots that are going on in Notting Hill Carnival in the 70s, and then also thinking about rioting and the far right in episodes to follow, and the media and politics and their place in this kind of story. So we've set the context here. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and I hope you will be back next week, not in 2 weeks, weekly, for the next episode. All tickets for live shows are in the show notes. So if you would like to buy a ticket, please do. Don't hesitate. You know, you've got less than 2 weeks for the live show in King's Cross, and then the Imperial War Museum is coming up during Black History Month in October. So, you know, if you are one of those people that does get into the spirit of Black History Month, then please, that's your time. There'll be a live show, and, you know, tell a friend, bring somebody along with you that you think needs to know more about these histories. Especially someone, there are some real military war buffs out there, and it always shocks me how little they know about the Caribbean's contribution, considering it was a world war, and how much, you know, it should be assumed that there was a global presence of people fighting on either side. So yeah, I won't say anything more about that. Thank you all for tuning in to this week's episode. Apologies that it didn't come out last week, but we are on track and ready to go with episodes every week and some fantastic guests. Have a wonderful week. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.